we have been analyzing some of the problems that face civil government as it tries to represent the kind of principle embodied in the American structure. One of the ways to see some of these problems is to examine the Supreme Court decisions as they were rendered by John Marshall, one of the greatest Chief Justices of the United States. Some would say very definitely the greatest. John Marshall was a very brilliant man, a man of superior intellect and of deep conviction. Moreover, John Marshall was a very realistic man. He also knew the limitations of the court and the practical political considerations. We are going to look at a few of the decisions that he gave in order to see something of the problem of the young republic as it wrestled with the power, the authority, the function, and the limitations of civil government. During his era as Chief Justice, John Marshall wrote 519 of the Court's 1,106 decisions. Let us look first at John Marshall's opinion in the Marbury versus Madison case. Now, the Marbury versus Madison case was a difficult one, because Marshall knew he was walking a tightrope. Marbury was one of the midnight judges appointed by Federalist President John Adams just before his term expired on March 4, 1801. The new president, Thomas Jefferson, refused to give Marbury his commission. Marbury and three other appointees who had been denied their commission by Jefferson after having been appointed just before Adams' term of office had expired, petitioned the Supreme Court for a court order requiring a public official to perform his duties, a writ of mandamus. Now, Marshall knew that if he granted the writ, the Republicans would disregard it. So it would be useless for him to grant it. It was a foregone conclusion that the Republicans had no desire to do it, and especially his cousin Thomas Jefferson detested him and would certainly never go along with such a writ. But if he did not grant the writ, people would feel that the Supreme Court was evading its responsibilities, ducking out on an issue, avoiding a head-on collision. Marshall was really in a bind. Should he make a grandstand play and issue the writ and render the court into a position of impotence just to make a grandstand play? Because he could establish a precedent whereby presidents could say, well, so much for the court. And the court would quickly disappear into nothingness, into impotence. On the other hand, he could not disregard the plea as presented by Marbury and his associates. Now, how did Marshall handle this? He declared that it was the Secretary of State Madison's duty to deliver the commission to Marbury, but that the Supreme Court had no power to order Madison to do so, which was the case. He very frankly faced up to the situation. But in the course of it, he stated certain principles which now being embodied in a decision underscored certain things with regard to the American system that became progressively important. I'd like to read a few of these things. The government of the United States has been emphatically termed a government of laws and not of men. The powers of the legislature are defined and limited, and those limits may not be mistaken, and that those limits may not be mistaken or forgotten, the Constitution is written. To what purpose are powers limited, and to what purpose is that limitation committed to writing? if these limits may at any time be passed by those intended to be restrained. It is a proposition too plain to be contested that the Constitution controls any legislative act repugnant to it, or that the legislature may alter the Constitution by an ordinary act. A legislative act contrary to the Constitution is not law. It is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. If two laws conflict with each other, the court must decide on the operation of each. The judicial power of the United States is extended to all cases arising under the Constitution. Now, practically speaking, Marshall was impotent in this case. Practically speaking, what he did was to insist that the government is a government of laws, not of men. So whether you're a Federalist or a Democratic Republican, it is the supremacy of law that stands. And the Supreme Court is the interpreter of what the laws mean. So he very definitely made a very important point here. But even more significantly, in one of the most important cases in American history, the trustees of Dartmouth College versus Woodward, in February 2, 1819, John Marshall issued a decision which is one of the most important for you to know and to understand. Dartmouth College was established during the colonial period. However, the college became offensive in 1816 to the New Hampshire Republicans because now they had won power in the state. And they resented this college, right in the midst of their state, training up people who had a very contrary view, a very conservative view. It would be comparable, for example, to the state of Virginia tomorrow deciding, we resent the existence of Fairfax Christian School, Leesburg Christian School, and every other Christian school, and therefore we are going to insist that the boards of these schools, and we'll create a board if there isn't one, shall have so many people added to them as we name so that we can control these schools. The new law passed by New Hampshire took the control out of the old private board of trustees, who were Federalists, and it placed the board under the control of the state, which was now dominated by the Republicans. The old college board immediately went to court and declared that this violation of their charter was unconstitutional, and they sued to have the original charter restored, the charter that had been granted to them by the Crown years before. When the case reached the Supreme Court, John Marshall ruled that the New Hampshire law was unconstitutional because he ruled that a charter granted to a private corporation whereby it is incorporated is protected by the contract clause of the Constitution of the United States. Now, not only did he save Dartmouth College by this decision, but in a sense this was a Magna Carta for all corporations, business, nonprofit, religious, of any kind. It meant now when you secure incorporation from the state, that incorporation is a contract. And the state has no right to violate that contract. It cannot pass an ex post facto law and wipe you out, violate that charter. This is why businesses immediately and religious groups and every kind of body that had any kind of extended operation to conduct immediately sought incorporation. They recognized the validity of this decision as a charter of freedom. To be a corporate body today isn't it still an important thing? Now, there are all kinds of limitations that are regularly passed on corporations. The federal government and the state governments are afraid of corporations. They realize that there are certain freedoms that constitutionally and in terms of John Marshall's decision have been granted to corporations. He said, and it's a long decision, but just a few passages because it is so important. The American people have said in the Constitution of the United States that no state shall pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. In the same instrument, they have also said that the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under the Constitution. On the judges of this court, then, is imposed the high and solemn duty of protecting from even legislative violation those contracts which the Constitution of our country has placed beyond legislative control. And however irksome the task may be, this is a duty from which we dare not shirk. The will, then, commenting on what New Hampshire did, the will of the state is substituted for the will of the donors in every essential operation of the college. This is not an immaterial change. The Charter of 1769 exists no longer. It is reorganized in such a manner as to convert a literary institution molded according to the will of its founders and placed under the control of private literary men into a machine entirely subservient to the will of government. This may be for the advantage of this college in particular, and may be for the advantage of literature in general, but it is not according to the will of the donors, and is subservient to that contract on the faith of which their property was given. Now, with this decision, an important fact was established in American history. A constitutional fact. Remember, we said the Constitution was designed to protect persons and property. Now, property was given when corporate an additional safeguard in that it has the status of a person. Because a corporation is a legal fiction whereby an organization is created into a legal person. Now, the word corporation, to corporate, comes from corpus. We have that word as corpse, also in English. A corpse is a body. Now, corporation, therefore, is a body which is like a person in the eyes of the law, only it's a person that does not die, unless it voluntarily chooses to vote itself out of existence. Thus, if we used the illustration of Christian schools a little earlier. A Christian school incorporates. What happens? It does not die with the death of the founder to be then by law broken up in terms of inheritance taxes and heirs. It cannot die. It has a perpetual legal existence as long as it chooses to exist. And therefore, it is not subject to the inheritance tax. It may be subject to other taxes, like a person pays income taxes, and so corporations pay corporate taxes. But it now has the legal status of a person who does not die. Now, monarchy in the ancient monarchistic governments represented a kind of corporation. So that when a king died, the declaration was, does anyone know how the death of a king was announced? You'll know it the minute I say it. The king is dead, long live the king. Why? Because technically the monarch was always alive. One figure occupying the office had died. But the prince or the successor was to take office soon, and the king was always alive in some sense. Therefore, the king is dead. Long live the king. the monarchy represented a kind of corporation. As a result, the sanctity of contracts was affirmed and freedom for corporations of all kinds, business, educational, and otherwise. This decision is an important one for us to recognize and never to underestimate the importance of the corporation in American life. The day may come when corporations will be under severe attack legislatively to try to make it difficult for them to come into existence. But if it had not been for Marshall's decision establishing the security of the corporations, we would never have had the tremendous growth of business corporations, educational institutions, and the like, because now they were protected from the arbitrary seizure of politicians. You would have otherwise had the kind of thing you had in New Hampshire in the Dartmouth case. Any administration coming into office would immediately take over control by an act of legislature every private institution, every business corporation within the state. This was prevented by John Marshall. Then, in 1819, a very, very important decision in McCulloch versus Maryland, March 6, 1819. In this case, the Bank of Maryland, the state of Maryland, attempted to tax the Bank of the United States within its boundaries. Now, we shall deal tomorrow with the very important issue in the morning of the Bank of the United States and Andrew Jackson. It was an early forerunner of the Federal Reserve. It is not something that we as Christian conservatives could have favored. But the fact is, it was a federal institution, a federal agency, and a branch bank in Maryland was immediately taxed by the state of Maryland. And so, this went to court immediately, because McCulloch, the cashier of the Baltimore branch of the Bank of the United States, refused to pay the tax. Now, in the course of his decision, in which John Marshall emphatically denied the right of the states to tax anything in the way of federal property or installations in the boundaries of any state, he also made a statement of incalculable importance, which is something that we still have to reckon with, because in other areas we have not come up with an answer to it. John Marshall refused to allow the states the right to tax something of the federal government because he realized that if they could, they could wipe out the federal government any time they saw fit. If you do not like the IRS, for example, and you have an IRS office in your state and there are offices in every state to collect taxes, what can you do? Well, if you have the right to tax the federal government, you can take that particular installation and tax it so heavily that it becomes impossible for the federal government to maintain the office, or any office. You could kick every federal office out of the state of Virginia. Might be a good thing. But you could do it illegitimately if that power to tax had not been overthrown by John Marshall. And John Marshall recognized the consequence. Well, Virginia may not like something. Here is Maryland. They don't like something. Another state doesn't like something. And all of them are given a veto power on the United States. Whatever they do not like about the federal government, they can tax when it comes into their state and wipe it out. And so, he summed up this fact in a very important sense. The power to tax involves the power to destroy. The power to tax involves the power to destroy. Now again, you see, this is a tremendous insight, but it leaves immediately some questions in your mind. Is it then a legitimate power of the federal government and of the state government to destroy me and my property? They have the right to tax my property and yours. They have the right, in terms of the existing order of things, to tax this school. The power to tax involves the power to destroy. And as I said earlier, last week, in Britain, this power was used to wipe out all great estates after World War II. Just pass a tax, which will be about 120 or up to 140, 45% of a man's income. And what happens? Well, he cannot pay you all of his income. He has nothing to eat on. But if he has to pay that much of his income, that high a percentage, he's not only going to take, let us say, 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 or 80% of his income and live on a pittance, but he's going to have to take many of his assets, his lands, his properties, and sell them to pay you off. The power to tax definitely involves the power to destroy, and in one country after another, it has been used that way, to destroy. So, now as we're dealing with the problems of government, here was a tremendous fact which Marshall very early saw, but which the Constitution and the state governments have not dealt with. So we can well recognize and readily recognize that one of the great problems that faces us in the generation or so ahead is, how shall we deal with the problem of taxation? Because taxes tend to grow in one form or another. And today we have taxes in various forms. Because, first of all, there is the tax which we pay directly. Second, the federal government raises money through bonds and debts and funds the government that way, and we pay for that. Not in a direct tax, but in indirect taxes we pay. And then the third tax is by paper money, which is inflation. So that you're being taxed continually. Now, with this kind of tax, you probably have lost about 10% of your income this year, as against last year. So if you've made just as much this year as last year, as you can tell any time you go to the grocery store or go to any kind of market or buy gas, you've lost 10% of your purchasing power. Whatever you have in the savings bank, it's 10% less approximately. You've lost that much in purchasing power. There's the power to destroy. And various governments all over the world, their taxes only go up. In one of my books, I've cited Italy, where if they ever collected all the taxes, and for good thing for the Italians, they're very inefficient. The taxes now equal 120% of everybody's income. That's only because the government is too ineffectual to be able to collect all the taxes that they can go along and put money in the bank and save it. But your property taxes are not going down, I'm sure, nor your income taxes. Your Social Security taxes have taken a big jump. It does involve the power to destroy. This is a problem that no government in the world yet has been able to deal with. It is a problem that the American system has not faced up to, but it's going to, because the day of reckoning is not too far ahead. Of course, in my biblical law, I deal with the answer that God has provided, the answer to the problem of taxation, so that it does not become the power to destroy. But at least Marshall recognized this and did a great deal to state the issue, at least, that we face. Perhaps before we go on, since this issue of taxation is so important, does anyone have a question about it? Because it is one of the most important aspects of the Constitution and American history, and yet it is the unanswered one today. Marshall simply stated the problem. Only dealt with it in one area. Yes.
would be the answer to the status limitation on the amount of tax any voting level of government?
Yes. Well, in biblical law, I deal with that, and I point out how, according to Scripture, God stipulates that the only kind of civil tax can be a head or full tax, which is the same for all males 20 years old and older. Neither too much nor too little for rich or poor, so that every man pays the same amount. And that takes care of the basic expenses of government, courts and defense and the like, police, but and apart from fines. Fines after that. But the basic government is through what we were discussing last week, the voluntary associations, God's tax, the tithe. So that through the tithe you take care of not only religion, but health, education, welfare, and a wide variety of things. Now this was once being done all over medieval Europe, and it was being done by the Puritans. And we have abandoned it to adopt the modern humanistic form of taxation, and it is destroying us. It is not likely to go down. And not even administrations that are opposed to taxes do anything but raise them. You know, the Reagan administration has gained a great deal of publicity in California for its recent proposition to put a ceiling and a limit on taxes, which was a good measure. But while it lost, it gained a great deal of favorable publicity for Governor Reagan, who is almost certainly planning to run for the presidency in 1976, and I don't think that publicity hurt him. He gained a reputation as a man who's concerned about taxes. On the other hand, taxes certainly went up very sharply under Governor Reagan. So while he's very much for a ceiling limit on taxes, we didn't see any limit in terms of his administrations. The tax problem has not been solved in our society. God's answer is the only one. Any other questions?
When did the taxes, were they first
noted
on the land?
On the man?
On land.
On land. Oh, a very good question. The question, when did the first land tax come into the United States? During most of the colonial period, there was no tax on land. Just at the very last, in a few places in New England, a few localities, they began to do it partly as a wartime measure. And in Virginia, for example, until the War of Independence, the only kind of tax was the poll tax and the tithe. That was all. Then they began to issue some special wartime taxes, which somehow stayed when the war was gone. The land tax crept in only after the War of Independence, first of all in those areas that moved towards deism and Unitarianism, which is an interesting fact. The land tax was the last of all to creep into the South. The South resisted it the longest. Now consider the security it gave a man in those days. He had no tax on his income and he had no tax on his land. It was because of this fact in the colonial period that James Otis could say, in terms of the biblical principle, a man's house is his castle. Well, your house is your castle if the tax collector can't come on your property and take possession of it to, in the name of back taxes, you see. So the land tax is a very interesting fact. Oh, one of the interesting things, when the First Continental Congress met, I think in early 1774, one of their first acts was to send a petition up to Canada asking the Canadians to join with the colonies in resisting Britain. And when they listed the horrors that would be theirs if they stayed under British rule, one of them was that your land, your property is going to be taxed one of these days if you stay with those nasty Britishers. It's an ironic fact when you look back on that and realize what our property taxes are today. But that actually to them was, you know, one of the ultimate things in tyranny. One of these days, Parliament may throw a land tax, a property tax on them. Any other questions? The South was also, by the way, the last one to adopt public schools. They did so only when it was forced on them by Reconstruction.
It seems that for a wartime assassination, a vulnerable decision, because, we can look back to the Second World War,
mm-hmm.
and see the many measures that were adopted to further state power.
Yes.
And I'm sure this happened in the First World War, which,
very markedly. In this century, every war has been recognized as an opportunity to increase the powers of the state markedly, as a means of peaceful revolution. Some years ago, I knew an old a veteran of Capitol Hill who had done a great deal of work in American history and the like, and he said before World War I there were already certain scholars of socialistic proclivities who had concluded that one of the best ways to further their socialistic designs, and remember Woodrow Wilson campaigned on the Square Deal platform, a semi-socialistic platform, was to help get this country into the European war, because during wartime, emergency powers can be established, only some of which are removed. Well, we came out of World War I a much less free country. We lost more freedoms in World War II, in Korea, and in Vietnam. With each war, we lose some freedoms.
What has happened in the War of Independence? Maybe is there something that does cause a certain foundation?
Well, no, it's happened in recent wars. It did not happen in earlier wars. It's because, of course, people have tumbled onto the power an emergency situation gives. So, the War of 1812 did not increase federal powers, for example, nor the War of Independence, nor the Mexican War. About what? Yes. Yes. Well, not necessarily so. You see, one of the problems in the War of Independence was that the federal government had no taxing power, and therefore it was issuing paper currencies. The state governments had a problem, and this is why an emergency tax was sometimes necessary, whereas under normal circumstances it would not have occurred, in that very often a great deal of the country would be occupied. For example, if, as a legislator of Pennsylvania or of New York State, you found that some of the best portions of Pennsylvania were in the enemy's hands, you would have a problem raising the normal amount of taxes, you see. So it did create a peculiar situation and particular problems, in that you no longer had a normal situation with a normal number of taxpayers. Now to come to another decision of John Marshall, very briefly, Gibbons versus Ogden in 1824. In this decision, there was a real problem involved in that Robert Fulton, after he had successfully developed his steamboat, the Clermont, on the Hudson River in 1807, received from the New York State Legislature, together with his partner, Livingston, exclusive rights to operate vessels driven by steam on the waterways of New York. Now, somewhat later, they worked out a contract with a man named Aaron Ogden to operate steamboats between New Jersey and New York. But meanwhile, still another man, Thomas Gibbons, got a license from the federal government to operate steamboats on the coast. So he began to run steamboats between New Jersey and New York in competition with Ogden. As a result, Ogden was very upset. He had paid good money to Fulton and Livingston to have the right to that particular run. And it was a good source of income. And now suddenly here was competition from a bigger outfit, and he was in trouble. So he appealed to the New York courts to stop Gibbons from competing with him because his claims were prior to those of Gibbons. Ogden won his case in the lower courts, but then he lost his case when it reached the U.S. Supreme Court in 1824. Why? Because the thesis of John Marshall in Gibbons versus Ogden was that neither Fulton and Livingston nor the state of New York had any power to grant any right to interstate commerce to anyone. And therefore, Ogden had no legitimate contract insofar as a steamboat going from New Jersey to New York was concerned. Any such steamboat was within the jurisdiction of the federal government. It was interstate commerce. Going up and down the Hudson River was one thing, but crossing state lines immediately put it into the jurisdiction of the federal government. Now, the practical effect of this was far-reaching in that it forbade monopoly wherever there was a state line involved. And it was a tremendous boon to free enterprise. It meant that instead of, say, one railroad getting the rights to go across state lines because a state had granted a charter and it had cleared with both states, the federal government could say there could be three railroad lines, or five, or ten. So free enterprise in every area involving any crossing of state lines immediately began to boom. It was a tremendous asset to the business world. However, there was a limitation here in that it was subject to Congress, so that the power of Congress to control interstate commerce and the development of the Interstate Commerce Commission, as it later came into being, then began to reach into intrastate commerce, commerce within a state. It doesn't do that totally, but to a great extent it does. So that now, of course, the federal government technically has the right to grant a monopoly. It doesn't quite do that, but it does impose a restraint of trade. Thus, the airlines all have the same fares. There's really no competition. On the other hand, the routes are created by the permission of the federal government, so the federal government can create a route where there is no need for one, technically, to be in competition with another line, but with the same fares, so that they're all penalized by having the same fare. They're non-competitive, and once being given this route, they can't drop it. Whereas if you were operating under fully free enterprise, you would say, well, this run isn't profitable, we'll drop it. No, you have to go to a federal commission to get permission to get the route or to drop the route. So that while for a time this decision was very, very important, It has now become a problem. Not every aspect of the problem was solved. Only one aspect. Now we've gone into these decisions so that you might see something of the problems of American government. The kind of thing it represents, a voluntaristic tradition coming from the grassroots up instead of from the top down, certainly, we agree, is superior. But it also means problems, and the reason why the Constitution was created so that amendments could be written was precisely because the founders recognized that they did not have perfection, that they were destined to have problems, and they wanted an instrument that could be flexible and could deal with problems. Well, it has a longer tradition of stability and of one continuous government. The only other one that can compare to it is Great Britain. But even Great Britain in the last century had a major legal revolution which in effect overthrew the existing form of government, in that the power of the monarchy was sharply curtailed, the House of Lords, which had been very powerful, became very weak, Commons was opened up to groups which previously had not been able to vote or to become members of Parliament, and the structure of England was drastically changed. But we, from the adoption of the Constitution to the present, have had the same form of government. We are not without problems. We have indicated tonight something of the nature of those problems, serious ones such as taxation, serious ones in that we are having a conflict between our traditional form and this in the tradition of Rousseau. But when you realize how often in Europe some governments have changed, it is a startling recognition. We think of Europe as the old world. But I was very interested some few years ago in chatting with a friend, Dr. Erich von Kuhnelt-Ledin, an Austrian count, one of the leading political scientists of the Catholic faith today, a very brilliant man. And Dr. Kuhnelt-Ledin remarked, he said, you know, the term the old world and the new world are not very appropriate. He said, this is the old world over here nowadays. He said, I'm an Austrian, and in my lifetime I have been under five different flags, five different kinds of government in Austria. I don't recall all of them, but there was certainly the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. There was the regime that took over afterwards. There was the Nazi regime. There was the Soviet military regime. And today, the Austrian Republic. Violent revolutionary changes, every one of them. And in one country after another in Europe, this has been normal. Whereas we have, during our entire history since the ratification of the Constitution, been under one basic form of government. The changes have been very great. But there has been enough of a flexibility to make possible absorbing those changes. Moreover, the possibilities of change exist in every direction. Because of the voluntaristic principle, we, though we have been absorbed to a degree by this, do not look to a group of elitists to tell us what we really think. But we still are able to express what we think. And as a result, we can, if our faith changes, change the character of the country. We can create voluntaristic institutions, and institutions such as Christian schools, as I indicated last night, are rare outside of our country, outside of Canada too, which is influenced heavily by us. But the kind of grassroots institution to deal with one problem after another exists only here, nowhere else in the world. And so we are still, to a great degree, very much alone in the world in having this principle. I think a great deal of the future of the world depends on the restoration and the further development of this. Are there any questions then? Yes.
We've been talking about some of the changes that have been seemingly great. One issue that comes to mind is the Electoral College issue. Last couple of elections, it seems, I know previous president, last couple of elections, there's been a lot of talk about doing away with the Electoral College. Do you see this as a fairly serious change that would be brought about, or is this just a minor?
Yes. No, the purpose of the Electoral College was a very important one. However, in a sense, I think I mentioned this at one of our morning groups, but it's important enough to go into again. Its original purpose has been frustrated. As it was originally created, each electoral district, each congressional district, named one elector for the Electoral College. It was not a case of the winner take all in each state. So in the early days, Virginia might cast electoral votes for four or five different candidates for president. When the winner-take-all method was adopted by the states, because the Constitution left it to the states to adopt, but assumed they would adopt it as one per district. With winner-take-all, it meant that the big cities and then the minority groups control in each state because they passed the swing vote in each state. The Electoral College today, therefore, and for about a century or more since the 1830s, has not served its original purpose. It still has value. I regard it as a marvelous thing, and I wish it could be restored to its original function. I don't think the prospect of doing away with the Electoral College is too good. 4 or 5 years ago, or a little longer ago, there was a great deal of likelihood that it might be done. There were some measures introduced in the Senate that seemed to go a long ways toward that. On the other hand, there was a measure introduced by Senator Mundt, M-U-N-D-T, which would have restored much of the original function. For a while, it seemed promising that something might result, but it all died. And right now,